Welcome to the Backpack Show.
I was going to whip out that Connecticut School of Broadcasting voice that people have sometimes.
Welcome to the Backpack Show. I'm Chris Brogan.
Wouldn't that weird out our guests?
When they would talk right up to the beginning of the song.
Yep.
Like, coming at you, 17 degrees and snowing in North Reading, Mass.
Here's a little Waylon.
Cool in the gang.
My mom and dad were DJs. My mom and dad were radio DJs. Dad was the morning news guy.
What didn't they do?
My mom was this. Oh, my dad had like five jobs when I started realizing that people had jobs. But none of them were as cool as running the Backpack Show with you.
Aww.
Who do we have for guests today?
Well, we have. So first, you have to know that my kids are baseball nuts. And so very excited to have artist Tim Carroll with us. He makes art out of cut up sports cards. So that sounds like very time consuming, and I have questions about it, but you have to see it. It's amazing. His stuff's on display at sports museums. There's private commissions. People want this art. You have to look at it. He recreates like vintage famous sports cards, like Sandy Koufax, out of cut up, you know, little like not rare cards. So very excited about that. We also have Dr. Cheryl Ingram, the founder of Inclusology. And we're going to talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion as a software as a service product.
I've been looking through this all morning in Inclusology, and also over the weekend, and I'm just like, to think of it as a software, it makes perfect sense. And also, I'm just so stunned that nobody had figured out that they needed to do this. But right? I guess that's why we need Dr. Cheryl Ingram.
If you look at the results, there's better retention, there are fewer complaints. It's really powerful stuff.
Oh, we've got some questions today, Carrie.
Hi, everyone. Tim Kitzer from NBA Jam and NFL Blitz. Welcoming you to The Backpack Show. Your hosts, Chris Brogan, Kerry Gorgone, Boom Shakalaka.
Backpack Show.
The weather report in Boston right now looks like there's going to be a blizzard coming in today. It'll be about 8 inches. I used to do this stuff all the time.
Coach Woodard.
Did you really, like with shtick and all?
When I worked at the phone company for repair service, I would have to say over and over and over and over again, doing the telephone repair, my name's Chris, can I have the telephone number you're reporting a trouble with? And it was automated. It was a human system, not automated. Oh. So when I was working on hurricanes and stuff like that, we'd be there 14 hours a day. And so I would do all kinds of silly things. So
I used to have guys call me every once in a while, and I'd pretend to be the operator. Be like, nice. The number you have reached is not in service.
Look, I'm going to do something I always forget to do. You're not in service. You're out of line. I'm going to do something I always forget to do, which is do our ads at the beginning. So, hey, look, we're sponsored by PubSite. If you're an author, you know, when you decide to get some Inclusology and beyond out there into some new books, put them up on PubSite, pub-site.com. You don't have to go looking around for an author website. They did it for you. Super fast and easy. 14-day free trial. 13 and a half days into it when you forget to make the website. Go sit down and do it. It'll take you 2 hours. You'll be so happy.
It's super easy and customizable. You know what? Tim Carroll, you need a book. So get yourself a website. Because you could make like a coffee table book.
Coffee
with all your
table
art in
book.
It. Mm-hmm.
PubSite, pub-site.com. Get some. We're sponsored by StreamYard. You can make a show like this. You can find smart people, lure them out of their beds in Malibu, and convince them to come on a show, sight unseen. See brogan.me/StreamYard. Look how easy it is to make a show. Even trained monkeys can do it. And Carrie.
Shut up.
Sponsored by Johnsonville. Do you like sausages? I sure do. I think Tim Carroll likes an occasional sausage. I'm just going to guess on that one. He says yes. All right. Johnsonville Sausages, you want us to send you some for free. All you got to do is make a video in return. Carrie@chrisbrogan.com. We'll send you Johnsonville Sausages. Johnsonville Appreciation Day number 2 coming up. By the way, Twitch.tv.
I mean,
Twitch.
A video of you doing something with the sausage.
Well, something eating, I'm hoping. Food, food, sausage.
Yeah.
Food. Yeah.
All right. But our first day on Twitch today.
Yes. Hey, Twitchers. Put down those video games. You don't have to watch people play Among Us. I'll tell you who's sus.
My kid will only let me play with an unplugged controller. Because apparently I'll lose important things.
Oh my gosh. The only thing worse in the world.
And I'm like, honey, I haven't been good at a video game.
Hey, Troy.
Sonic. So.
I'm pushing for that yellow card. Well, I warned the guests that, you know, we have a yellow card
that was
scenario.
Possibly. Let's do this.
Yeah. Well, I want to grab Dr. Cheryl Ingram first. I want to talk a little bit about Inclusology. I have so many questions. Oh, my gosh. This is crazy shenanigans. Hello, young miss. How are you? Thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, no problem. I'm great. Thank you all for having me. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
All right. So it is the very first day of Black History Month, the one month where a lot of companies have to scramble and pretend they care about people of color for a minute. But maybe Maybe this will be the year that we go beyond chief diversity officers at Stubble the kids' judge. Table.
So, I'm judge? Sorry, our first Twitch comment is from Stubble Judge.
Hey, Stubble Judge. Thanks for coming and seeing us over there, baby.
That's Dan Gorgone.
Oh, is it? I didn't know. That is hilarious. That's a great name, too. Uh-huh. Cheryl, you have software to help people figure this out. So when you say this, and when we talk about things like, you know, machine learning and all that sort of a thing for this, what are we talking about? What are we sucking into the fan blades for data? And what are you actually doing for some companies with this product?
Yeah, so what we're sucking into the fan base for data is every employee experience that you can think of broken down by every identity that you have. So often we like to take, there's 14 places to cover in the workplace, right? There's 14 categories that usually fall under diversity, equity, and inclusion that cover things that most people don't tend to focus on. When we think about DEI, you see a lot of companies that say, oh, we just need to recruit more people of color or more BIPOC, right? Black and Indigenous people of color. And it's like, actually, that's not it. It's diversity and then what, right? And so I'm doing the diversity and the then what. So we take 14 different categories from diversity, equity, and inclusion, and we ask employees a set of questions around different things that we need to know about their company. So it could be recruitment, retention, it could be product, it could be communication in your company, it could be your leadership and accountability. What we've done is develop this question bank that actually helps people ask the right questions. And then we built these algorithms that help people understand how to break the results of those questions down by every identity that a human being has to look for trends where discrimination exists. And I'm saying it with a smile because you get some great things and then you get some really shitty things. Can I curse on
here? Yeah, sure. Why not?
Okay.
Who's coming?
And once you do that, We not only rank you and benchmark you to tell you how you're performing against other companies in our database, but then we also give you solutions because, you know, people have been talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion for a really long time, but nobody really tends to bring forth solutions that really help people change the issues. And I'm the person that's working with the team to do that.
So I already have a million questions. When you talk about the questions, it's very interesting. We just talked to a mother-daughter company that make a product that when back in the old days when we went to face-to-face events, this was a way better way to try to get people to connect with each other. You've ever been to an event, doctor? You go to that horrible, like, you know, stupid app that they make you download, and it's never useful, and it never connects you with good people. What they did was, like, similarly, they asked really good questions. They asked, you know, like, But fun questions, you know, if you were in a band, would you be the lead singer or the, you know, backstage producer and all that? So it's trying to get your introversion, your extroversion. I saw some of what you were looking for. I saw some of what you're asking for questions. Do you feel like, well, I mean, with any kind of product like this, it's garbage in, garbage out. Yeah. Are companies ready for this, or how hard is it to fit them up so that they can do something like this kind of a project? It looks important.
Yeah, some companies are not, to be fair. And usually the people who are not have really not done the deep dive for diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so what I mean is that companies have to understand that you have to mentally prepare to see some of the shit that you're going to see, right? And so we've had clients who have seen it, who have seen the good results and the bad results, because we point out both, right? Because people love to hear what they're doing well, but not so much about what areas where they may really be struggling. And so we've seen companies that have taken it, and it's kind of waking them up. And then they've taken a break. They've backed off to think, oh, no, what are we going to do to fix it? And they walk away and then they come back after they figure it out. And then we have companies who really dive in when they see that there's things that they're doing well and things they're doing really terrible. And they try to fix it. Right. They start working with us to change the issues and get to the root cause. But if your leadership is very resistant and they're not interested in change, then your company is probably not ready to hear what our data is going to show you.
So let's say that the data that comes back isn't ideally what they're going for. Like, everybody likes to think that they're an anti-racist organization, but you discover that maybe in recruitment areas they're not. So what then can you do as kind of the bearer of bad news to present that in a way that shows them the opportunity to improve how they're doing things, like the results that they can have if they improve?
Yeah. So there's one thing we've learned about society. People really want results quickly. Right. And right now. But one thing that people are starting to forget is creating sustainable change. So one of the things that we do to help companies is say, here's the things you can do immediately to start fixing this. And here's the things that are long-term that you can accomplish over the next 3 years if you want to be realistic in setting your goals. Now, if you exceed them, great. But we also point out and compare how they're doing to other companies. And the thing that helps most companies is nobody's doing a spectacular job, right? So when you see that industry comparison and you see, okay, 70% of my company approves of my leadership, but 90% of that 70% are white people, then I know that we're doing really well with them. But what are we not doing so well with BIPOC and how do we change that? Or we're not doing so well with women. How do we change that? I'm even talking about thinking about identifying the fact that you might have sizeism in the workplace and mistreat people because they're not skinny, right? It's just the things that people really don't think about when we talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion. I'm like, let's equally weigh them all, but the data that comes back might not be so equal, right?
Sizism, ageism. I was at a company where we felt pretty good. We felt like we're really good allies. We have a high up Muslim guy on our team who's celebrating Ramadan, and he gets invited to 4 lunch events in the same week. And I finally was like, not that I'm somebody special in this world, but Ramadan means you have to fast until nighttime. Can we not have some lunch, meetings? So, I mean, no one thought about it. They just thought, well, it's nice to buy lunch for your team, right? Yeah. But maybe don't make important meetings around food. So it's interesting you cover all that. Carrie's question was so good. I want to double dip on it. She asked a question. So now you brought the bad news. Now what? You've had some time out there. You've done this a bit. What's the worst and the best of receiving bad news you've seen out there?
Oh, the worst. I have a few of those. The worst that I was in a room presenting to a large tech company about their DEI results, right? And it was their actual results. And this guy said, the one of the VPs in the room said, "Are you sure this is our company? Like, is this our data?" He was like, "How do we
That's
know?
That's not my kid."
Right. There's no way that I produced something that did this. Right. And I was like, yes, it is your company. I'm like, but, would you say that? Are you saying that about the good things that your company's doing? Or is it only when you see the negative things? Because it's great that you want to claim that things are amazing, but it's not so great when you claim that they're not. Well, after we did the assessment, that company walked away. They were like, we're going to figure it out. Well, guess what? Literally 3 months later, they were in the news for racial discrimination and sexism in their company. The same things we had pointed out in our assessment. Right. And it was like, now you can't even use us as a resource to say that you're fixing it because you walked away from us. But you want to come back to us and say, hey, can we put your face on our website to talk about how we're doing DEI work? No, we haven't seen y'all in 3 months. Right. The best of it is when we see companies, for example, we work with a really large engineering firm that has multiple locations around the nation. And they looked at their DEI results and they're like, what's the plan? Right. And so we show them the plan and they've been with us for it'll be out 3 years. And you should just see the change. Like, for example, their leadership approval rating went from 30% to 77% in 9 months. It's like if you invest and you see that there's a problem, you actually invest, people notice. And when they notice, they become happier at work, they get bought in and they become more invested. And so that's like the best of the best. And the worst of the worst are people that walk away. Best of the best is the people that stick with us and actually see change. Like, we've used some of our methodologies with both companies to rebuild our technology, because you need to learn the good and the bad. You can't just build based on the good shit because then you overlook the bad things.
Mm-hmm. So there are results that I think anybody would appreciate at the C-level, the C-suite level. And when you're coming in to talk about things like diversity and inclusion and not being racist, it's like they agree that those are good things, but they're not necessarily willing to invest until you point out to them that they're going to have actual results. Like retention, for example, has a dollars and cents result for them. And not having complaints against them actually has a dollars and cents in the long run and PR value and all that kind of stuff. So how do you present what you do to executives in a way that will make them see the value, even though like they should see it without that, but let's say that they don't.
Yeah. And one thing I'm learning is executives love numbers. They love data and they love profit. Right. And so one of the things that we pitch when we talk about the way that we collect our data, through our marketing is to say those things. Like, we save you an average of $40,000 per year for employee based on the turnover rate and what companies spend on average, right? We show the improvement levels of leadership. We show the ROI, which often takes us anywhere from 12 to 24 months to really start to accurately be able to calculate that. And so when people see that, when executives see that, they're like, oh, but not only that, sometimes when executives don't know what to do, they don't need you complaining about what they haven't done. They need you to show them what they should be doing, right? And so when you give them strategy and you show them those things, they're more likely to buy into your cause and say, okay, I can do that. I know how to do that. Or I know someone who knows how to do that, right? So it's like, don't just present the problem, present the solution, and then present the outcomes that show them the numbers.
You are yet another recipient of the American Express 100 for 100 program. Yes. That means American Express did one of those things that you don't see a lot of companies really doing. They put their money out there with it. And they said, we're going to throw $2.5 million at 100 wonderful Black women entrepreneurs. And Carrie got the super smart idea of poaching the hell out of that list. And one of the things we learned, Dr.
With some help. From Nikki Porche,
Buy From a Black Woman told us, you know what you ought to do. And every single person, this is not to make you seem like a pile of people, but every single person from that list talks amazing, talks, you know, perfectly about what they're selling, says it like they've been pitching for such a long time. How long has it taken to get this dream to where you want it to be? You said you own all the trademarks and all that. This is a big project for you, Inclusology. How long has it been between you saying to somebody, there's got to be a better way to being this you?
Yeah, 21 years.
Woo! 21. So you started when you were 4, is what you're saying.
When I was 19. Wow. I mean, I started doing this kind of work, I can recall all the way back in when I was 6, right? But the first time I was like, something got to really change. I was 19. I was in college.
So as a Black woman in tech, what do you perceive as the differences in terms of how you were treated by potential investors, by people to whom you would pitch your idea, especially because your idea directly takes on the problems of racism and other kinds of discrimination in the workplace? So were you met with like, oh, that's cute, or of course she would have this idea? Like, what kinds of resistance did you run up against and how did you overcome it?
Yeah, I tell people I'm often pushed away with closed arms. You know how people are open arms and they receive you? I receive the opposite from many people. And, you know, I'm very blunt. And some people say sometimes to a fault, and being Black and being a woman and being that way is not always received well in what we consider professional spaces, right? And so I've seen the best and the worst of people. And I would say the best and the worst outnumber the best 3-1, right? Because I have a whole documentary where people, I've been told, you're smarter than you look, by white executives and companies when I go in to present. I've been told, you're very articulate. Or, you know, I've gone into companies and I talk about DEI as an umbrella, right? But they never see past the fact that I'm a Black woman. They're like, oh, she's gonna come in here and tell me what white men are doing wrong. I'm like, I'm gonna tell you what any privileged identity is doing wrong. Now, if one is more prevalent than the other, I'm gonna speak to that more prevalently, you know? And so it's always the shit like that. Like I've pitched my business 164 times. I've received one investment. Two investments from the same investor. Wow. So we call it one investment, right? When I was graduating from college and I was applying for DEI positions, I applied for 444 positions. I got 2 interviews. You know, it's like being Black and already being growing up in poverty and marginalized already presented its own barriers. But then when I started stepping over those barriers and pushing them out of the way, it seemed like more barriers just come. And I'm still going through that. I can't, you know, I was once in a business accelerator where a white executive, the CEO, told me, you should watch Asian women and how they carry themselves.
Oh my gosh.
He's like, that calmness, that thing that they have, that really appeals to people. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me?
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Oh my gosh.
That's what I was thinking.
Well, I just, as you said that, I was funny because I just started biting the inside of my mouth because I said, I almost sounded like that when I said to you, you sound so great at how you, what I meant is, boy, you sure are pitching this well, you know, nothing to do with who you are or where from. But just a good business pitch. We do a lot of interviews on the show, and it's amazing how many people can't talk about their own business that they say they're passionate about, how much they love. And it's very refreshing to hear big energy about a project like this. So, woo, you got nowhere to go but up. So, listen, we can find you on Inclusology. We can go to inclusology.com, and you can see, go to the About page and look at what the beautiful hair Cheryl's rocking in that picture, too. Ooh.
That's not me. Oh, my God, Chris.
Is that not you?
Oh, yes. Here we go.
Be Where's quiet. The on the About page, Dr.
Yellow Card Brogan. Yeah, I'm about to cut your mic off.
Oh, never mind. That's me. That's correct.
You don't you be like that.
I'm sorry.
I was like,
oh, my gosh.
Oh, lady, come here. Hang on. Look right there. Look at that hair right there.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Look at that blue jeans. That is a
doctor.
You know
what, though? This is getting worse, actually.
No, I'm saying what a cool picture. That's what I was saying.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, you should have just said what a cool picture.
Yeah, a cool picture.
Boom shakalaka. Yellow card, Brogan. And Brogan is going down like a bag of hammers tonight.
Hair is never a safe space.
I know. We can't touch hair. Can't talk about hair. I get it. I love hair. All right, I'm kicking you backstage, but not because I just blew it. Good talking to you, Cheryl. Take care. Bye now. Boop,
you
boop.
Never end on a sustained objection, Chris.
I don't even know what you're saying. Hi, Lawyers, Tim Carroll.
Hi, Tim.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Good morning. We're going to talk, about your hair, Tim.
Tim, I love your hair.
I have no hair.
Beautiful hair.
That makes it easy.
It's a good look.
So I have to know how you became interested in baseball cards to begin with when you don't play. And where you grew up, there wasn't really like major league baseball. So how did this all come about? How did you develop an interest in cards in the first place, sports cards?
So I played little league baseball back in the 80s. And in 87, 88, I started just picking up packs of cards at a grocery store near the house. And this is back in my hometown of Fulton, Mississippi. And so I'm taking these cards, and I'm stacking them up just like everybody else. I'm flipping through them and reading the statistics, and just was fascinated by just the cards in general and all the colors of the uniforms. And I've been basically collecting since 87. I took a little bit of time off in the 90s, like most people do that collect. Once you get into your later years of high school and college, you kind of put those on the back burner, and you're more interested in what's going on with the girls and party life and things like that. So, I got married and kind of just started revisiting them a little bit later. But that's how I got into cards in general.
And what about art? Your interest in art? Because you can't do this for sure if you have no artistic talent, like without stuff to work with.
Well, I always I like to draw. When I was little, back in North Mississippi, there was not a lot of funding for the arts. So my school district, we didn't have art classes like a lot of places do now. I tell my own kids all the time, you have no idea how lucky you have it with so much money that's going into the arts and schools and the opportunities that you have to learn. But we didn't have that. So I didn't have my first art class until my senior year of high school, when a local college professor from a junior college came in and took 12 of us and just basically taught for free. And so he gave us some stuff to some foundations within art, and I ended up earning an art scholarship to that junior college. And life hits you, and I was not able to finish that. I was going to do some graphic design, and again, it was put on the back burner, joined the workforce. And then about, I would say 10, 12 years later, I'm finishing a degree up for elementary education, and my wife was, she was finishing up a doctorate in education, and she was presenting at a national science conference down in New Orleans. So we went to the French Quarter and started checking out all the cool art that was in the quarter, on Decatur Street. Voodoo art, body paintings, just some of the weirdest, the coolest stuff. And, it got the wheels turning, and then the rains came. And I think I think that downpour may have been like my lightning strike or something, because I stopped in at a gas station or a convenience store on the way back to the hotel room and picked up a magazine and saw that there was this little quarter page blurb about it being the 100th anniversary of the T206 Honus Wagner baseball card. And it's the $1 million, you know, at the time it was the only card that was anywhere near $1 million. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if there was a piece of artwork, kind of like something that we saw off, you know, in those art galleries on Decatur, something that dealt with that Wagner. And I looked over at my wife and I said, you know, cards are used for trading. And wouldn't it be neat to trade all those common cards that I had from my childhood in my closet for one of those $1 million cards? And she said, well, you certainly have enough of them. And I was like, that's not the way it works. It's not a quantity, it's a quality thing. But I got home and I started pulling those cards out, and I had no intentions of actually cutting them. I just started laying them and overlapping them. And one thing led to another. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to cut the borders off if I'm going to make this look anything like, you know, Honus. So I started clipping and gluing and clipping and gluing. And the next thing you know, I had this really crude Honus Wagner, basically the size of a poster. And I put it online as a joke, like, hi, I traded my common cards for a Honus Wagner. And I was not expecting the response that I got. It was overwhelming. And the internet is undefeated when it comes to taking stuff and putting it out there. I mean, these people took it and run with it. And it has been a ride ever since.
Well, I imagine some people, like Chip says in the comments here, this art looks pretty cool, but it pains me to see baseball cards getting cut up. What do you say to collectors and people who are enthusiastic about cards?
Well, in the card world, in the late 80s and early 90s, cards are considered, it's called the junk wax era. It's where they were so overproduced. Any given card, there's estimations of 50 million of the same card that's out there. So I could cut for the rest of my life, and I'm not going to even touch, putting a dent in the population of these cards. I don't cut Hall of Famers, anything that someone might really want. I mean, some of these sets still go for like an 88 top set. You can still find for $5. These are the kind of cards you find at garage sales in bulk for, you know, $20 for 20,000. This is not anything that's valuable. But instead of taking those common cards and just shoving them back in the closet and letting them collect dust for 10 or 15 years and knowing that they're still not going to be valuable because there's so many of them, it's a little bit better to kind of do something different with them and put them out in the open, hang them on the wall a little bit.
Tim, how big are these cards? What's the size? The painting, sorry, the portrait, the work. How big is your artwork?
So most of them are about 8 times the actual size of a baseball card. So the baseball cards are 2.5 inches by 3.5 inches for a standard size modern card. So they're, 20 inches by 28 inches.
Okay. So actually, now that I look at it, so this picture here, with Sandy Koufax, is that that's regular baseball cards to the left of him, and that's your work? That's about the sort of size?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay, there you go. We have Troy Rutter here. Troy's a collector, has been doing it for years and years and years, has a great YouTube show about it. So I knew I could shake down Troy and make him come on the show because he'd panic and see these things getting all ripped up. But you just explained what he sort of predicted as well, which is those kind of miserables. Chip Griffin says, I've got tens of thousands of late 80s cards gathering dust, so he's right. So
it's a common story.
Yeah. I was a comic book guy ever since the 70s into the 80s and 90s. And in the 90s, I guess they gave up on baseball cards and started doing the same in comics. So Stubble Judge on Twitch TV. Love that name. Oh, my gosh. I love the name. Common cards are probably priced at 1 to 5 cents each. It probably costs more to store them than it does to have them.
So I agree with that also.
Okay. Now, how's the process work? Like, I zoomed in on a bunch of these so people could see it after Carrie made that smart recommendation. And I'm looking at, like, you know, the side of Tiger Woods' head, and it's made out of a lot of other people's heads. Like, how's that work? What do? You just stuff through and look for the right tones and all that? How's it go?
Absolutely. That's exactly how it is. So I'm sitting on about 450,000 commons in my studio, and I pull them out. And I think my knowledge of cards from when I was a kid, you know, it comes in handy. Not only do I know the sets very well and what each set presents to me as far as color goes, but there are specific cards within those sets that I call my go-to cards. A 1987 Topps Brian Clutterbuck, who, you know, you're not going to see anyone collecting Brian Clutterbuck cards probably other than his family, or Brewers fans, you know, from the late 80s. And even then they have so many that they don't want those. But I use that card a lot because just because the light parts of skin tone, the Clutterbuck card lends itself well to that. Donnie Moore from 87 Tops, there's a green in the background that I've used that specific shade of green a lot. So the knowledge of those cards, and I just start off with a sketch, and I was a former math teacher. So I make sure that I scale it up to size, you know, with my sketches and with a grid approach. And then it's just cutting and gluing.
It's at once interesting and a little bit freaky to zoom all up on Jackie Robinson's head and find a whole bunch of eyeballs and faces in there.
That's the fun part about it, especially for collectors, because if you were a child of the 80s that collected cards during that time or watched baseball during that time, it's always fun to zoom in and say, oh, hey, there's Devon White. And, you know, like right at the top of Jackie's forehead right there, I see a snippet of an Ozzie Smith that accidentally got cut. Right above his eye, you can see Ozzie's eye. So, I can, you know, point out, and it's just fun. You know, it's definitely a talking piece to hang on the wall, something to look at and go and spend a few minutes looking over.
Can you imagine having a teacher that goes and cuts up sports cards for a living later and being like, well, hell, I really can do anything.
We had some fun in those classes before I quit. You know, I was always trying to do some things with the kids to get them involved, and we created a lot of different things. A huge 10-foot mural on one of the hallway walls out of bottle caps of local river walks. So we had some fun with the artwork.
You have an interesting collection of people on there. I'm curious, how do you know who you're going to pick for a subject matter? My guess is obviously you got to pick kind of the more likely, more famous people if you wanted to ever sell one of these. You don't get to pick all the obscure people, but how do you choose who you want to pick?
Mostly the cards that I like, or when back in 2016 when I was still teaching, the wait list was so long for commission work that my wife and I, you know, got to talking, and it was one of those things where we kind of decided, you know, something has to go. Either I need to put this aside and put it on the back burner a little bit and only, you know, do artwork here and there, or I need to step away from the secure job of teaching and focus on this full time, you know, just to give myself some a breather. And so I decided to go ahead and give it a shot. And if it didn't work, you know, I could always go back to teaching. But what I found was that the wait list just exploded. And so now, you know, commission work is primarily what I do. But it's still the most popular cards. Like you said, it's the ones that people want. And I don't only do each piece one time. So it's kind of like if you wanted the 52 Tops mantle, you're going to have to go and find it on the secondary market. And it has changed hands 2 to 3 times, just like a couple of other pieces recently, which, you know, blows me away that people are, you know, seeing like an investment type of side to it. Because, you know, what I do it for fun, do it for now, I do it for income. But at the same time, you know, a lot of people are taking it and swapping it, you know, and making money off them. It blows me away.
I know you addressed this earlier, but someone's come in saying again, like, are you increasing the value by reducing availability? What you're doing must have an effect, but you're saying there's just so many of these common cards you use that it really doesn't.
Right. But by reducing the availability of, you know, if you're talking about the creating them only one time, then yeah, that's probably, you know, adding the value to those pieces after I make them. I'm sure, because there's only so many Wayne Gretzky rookie cards, you know, there's only one of them that I make. And so once it's out there, you know, if someone else wants it more than the other, they're going to have to pay a lot more. So I guess, yeah, that, you know, it kind of makes sense that the value increases on those. As far as the comments,
though, right? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just saying you have actually gone back and redone some, like from earlier in your career when you were just getting your
three pieces, the Honus Wagner. And I consider those first three prototypes, and I still own those three pieces. I have no intentions of ever getting rid of those. I have them tucked back, you know, in the studio, and that's where they'll stay. But it was the Honus Wagner, the 52 Tops mantle, and the King Griffey Jr. 89 upper deck card. Those three were just, they're just so popular that after 10 years of doing this, my skill level now, the goal is always to get better with everything that I do. And so my skill level, you know, at this point was so much higher than what it was when I first started. I felt I did not do those pieces justice by, you know, with the work that I did at the beginning. So I went back, instead of, you know, treating them more like a concept piece where it was not a joke, but just kind of like just for fun. It was a lot. There's a lot more seriousness to it now. And I really am happy I went back and redid those pieces.
Now, I'm also very curious when you're going to get going on Pokemon cards and stuff like that, so you can get me a big old Pikachu or something.
I have two teenage boys, and they're killing me for a Charizard. That comes up all the time. It's like, come on, Dad. And I tell them the same thing. Like, do you know how many hours that would take to do one of those with so much text, you know, on the card and all the full background? It would be quite a project.
How much lawn mowing do you think they're going to have to do to cover that little bill?
Well, I probably wouldn't have to do the lawn for a while.
But, you know, if you cut up cards for kids, you know, they never learn how to do it themselves. So,
right. Oh, right.
Yes, yeah. Teach them. Take on a couple of apprentices. Right.
Twitch TV viewer Stubble Judge says it's amazing. You know, it's amazing that Tim's art is in the Baseball Hall of Fame, which is a huge achievement. Mm-hmm. Think about that. Just going as a regular old fan who has, you know, interest in cards that like doesn't even necessarily. You haven't even said, man, I watch every baseball game that ever was. You know, you just collecting the cards, and there it is in the Hall of Fame. The other thing he pointed out is you also evidently did a Garbage Pail Kid piece.
Atom Bomb. Yeah. Like I said, I'm a child of the 80s, so pop culture is my thing. I'm very literal. I'm really into the you know, the 80s stuff of Mike Tyson's punch out, the Garbage Pail Kids cards, you know, all the baseball cards of the time, Game Boy, Nintendo, that stuff. So it only makes sense to revisit the childhood stuff. You know, if I'm going to sit and look at it all day, might as well have the most fun that I can with it, you know.
Two long-lost friends have rejoined us on the Backpack Show community today. We have Carol back in full-fledged effect. Glad to see you here, Carol. And Nancy over in Scotland says, absolutely loving your art, Tim. You have Scottish fans now.
Thank you.
Now, is that one of the weirdest things about this whole experience is you get a whole bunch of fans all of a sudden, and you're thinking, man, I never, ever expected anyone to be my fan.
It's one of the coolest things just to be able to meet all the different people out there. I really do believe that everybody, every single person has a talent or something that they do that is much more unique than anyone else. It's just, have they found it yet, or are they capitalizing on it? Are they putting it out there and showing the world? I don't care if it's yodeling or cutting baseball cards or whatever. Everybody has something that they're really good at, and they just need to keep digging and finding it. And when they do find it, share it, show it, you know, let everyone else enjoy it. That's what it's all about. So meeting new people from this has been one of the best things that's happened.
If you had had more traditional tools to work with when you were exploring your artistic interests as a kid, do you think you ever would have made your way around to cutting up baseball cards?
Absolutely not. Everything in life leads you to something else. And when I was little, I would use pine cones. I would use pine cones and straw out on the playground to create pictures, pieces of cut cardboard that I'd paint and make little mosaics out of everything. You know, when I got a little bit older, I was working in a factory making leather furniture, and would take pieces of little, you know, leather scraps and lay it together, or take the plexiglass patterns from that leather, and I would do etchings on that. So different, whatever materials I had to use, I used. And I think everything just kind of leads you to the next phase and whatever it is you're supposed to do next. And I guess it's just kind of like, you got to walk through that door, you know, you got to take advantage of it.
We had artist Annika Jones on the show, and she did a lot of, someone said to her one day, gee, you know, you could probably be an artist. And she thought, huh, maybe I could. She'd never, it never even entered her mind. And so she did what everybody does, you know, if they get brought into an art school, is they start working with paint. And one of the teachers said, you know, maybe you ought to try some different mediums. Maybe you ought to try some weird stuff and see what happens. And next thing you know, she gets very famous for making embroidery art. That's embroidery. She stitched that into some fabric, right?
Beautiful.
So that's like what you said when you were down there in New Orleans and you started seeing all kinds of interesting stuff. Those are all pieces of thread. Now, in the background, there's some mixed media as well, because her pieces are like about stopping sex trafficking, that sort of thing. There's a big, important message underneath them. And this one, you know, there's the concept of targets on women. And there's also the concept of people being used in these bad situations. She makes art with condoms and all kinds of stuff. But it sort of follows that legacy of what you got going on, Tim, insofar as, you know, both of you are working with media that people don't normally associate with, you know, as a primary art piece. It's interesting what called to you. Do you ever get the urge to go out and just try something totally different, like, I don't know, guitar pick art?
Well, I think there's actually a section of it. You probably be able to find it online. I've created a Jimi Hendrix out of guitar picks.
You son of a gun.
I've got a Bob Marley out of guitar picks hanging in my studio. Elvis Presley out of broken records. I was born in Tupelo, so doing something of Elvis was natural.
You had to do that.
Absolutely. I'm like I said earlier, I'm very literal, and I like having fun, you know, and being kind of punny. There's a Frank Thomas, the former first baseman for the Chicago White Sox, was known as the Big Hurt. So I created, you know, Frank Thomas out of Band-Aids with Ace bandages wrapping. Yeah, there's my Jimi Hendrix on the right there. But
right here.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's amazing. Out of picks.
You got to do Dolly Parton now.
Yeah, my daughter would be all over that. Yeah, she's a Dolly fan.
Well, I have to bring back Miss not talking about her hair herself, Cheryl.
She can talk about it. You can't talk about it. So that's the point.
We have two people that followed their dreams in two very different ways. You know, you went off and became a doctor and said, I need to show the math so people make a choice. And Tim here said, you know, I think there's other ways to connect and express and all that sort of thing. I'm curious, Cheryl, when you were watching this, did you feel any kind of anything come up? What did it make you think of to watch this kind of thing go on?
To watch Tim?
Yes, ma'am.
It made me think. One of the things that really resonated with me is the fact that he talked about how he didn't have art when he was in school. Mm-hmm. And I think that it is a tragedy that we take arts out of the classroom and out of students and start to like denounce their creativity at an early age. I don't think that that's fair. I really love the creativity in what you do, Tim.
Thank you.
I went and looked at your website while I was chilling in the green room, I'm gonna call it. And I think it's amazing. I think you keep doing what you're doing. It's inspirational.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I mean, you know, obviously my work is not, it's not as globally as important as what Dr. Cheryl's, you know, her, what she's bringing to the table and the message that she's bringing out. But, you know, my stuff is just more like lighthearted and fun, you know.
Every guest says that, Tim, by the way. Every guest we've had on is like, why do you have to bring me on after Dr. Cheryl?
Well, exactly. You know?
Like they always feel like the poor cousin or something.
I think the world underestimates the contribution of art to our wellness.
Well, and representation matters too, right? I mean, if you don't see something, you can't be something. I just saw this cute picture of two little kids being dressed up to represent the inaugural event looks of both Barack Obama and Michelle Obama. And I thought, man, there's some kids out there going, I want to dress like that now. And I think that's where it starts, right?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, we had a big old show today. I mean, we're next to the... Oh, so let's see. Stubble Judge over on Twitch TV. I'm just going to keep saying his name. I made my own baseball card piece, and it hangs next to my desk. Brings me joy every day to see it.
He didn't cut anything. They're like arranged. Them? Yeah.
Okay.
Oh.
Okay.
Well, bring it in.
Yeah, let's bring it in.
I agree to arts being underestimated, the importance to our wellness, no question. That and music, oh my gosh, how many music classes are being canceled everywhere? You know, keep that sports program going, but we wouldn't want anyone to learn how to play guitar or nothing. That'd be terrible.
Really. I remember when I wanted to do band, they were like, you're going to do flute because we need people to play the flute. I was like, seriously?
Yeah, like court-appointed instruments. You don't get a choice.
So I got a rented flute that was like all banged up, looked like it was a car part or something.
That's funny. The same thing happened with me with the viola. I wanted to play the violin. They're like, we don't have any more. We ran out. Take this viola. I was like, oh, okay.
We ran out. Golly.
Look at this, though. This is Debbie. You probably showed this earlier, Carrie, but it says, so enjoyed. Shout out to teacher Tim. So Debbie was a high school principal for quite a long amount of time.
Oh, wow.
And Tim was so cool. Wouldn't you give cards sometimes as rewards, like to your students and stuff?
We would use the statistics on the back, you know, to teach math. You know, one of my first jobs teaching was actually there was a pilot program being run, and it was single gender classes. Just to see how to knock down the stereotypes of students. You know, most boy students were being basically, you know, it's almost like that they weren't supposed to be good in art, weren't supposed to be able to show all their stuff in class, like, you know, be proud of their grades. Girls were not supposed to be, quote unquote, you know, good in math and science. Yeah. And what we ended up finding out was my single gender group of boys had the number one attendance rate in the entire district. And the girl class next door to us, which was like our brother sister classroom, they had the number one math and science scores in the entire district. It was amazing to see that once you kind of just throw all that other stuff out to the side, how kids thrive. And it's not for all kids, but I used a lot of competition in those classes and used a lot of sports cards as rewards for the ones that wanted them. For the ones that didn't, I'd find something different. So,
yeah, it's amazing how, like, when I have data scientists and people on my team, and it was difficult, more difficult, but not impossible to find a female identified data scientist, right? Look at that.
So wow. Stubble Judge has brought this into view here. So.
Yeah, 59 tops.
Wow.
There it is.
Look at that.
Where's the Bob Gibson at?
I'm trying to remember.
Where's Bob Gibson?
Where's Bob Gibson?
I don't think Bob Gibson's on this.
Be here a while.
Wow.
I guess you need another one.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Part two of the project.
Stubble Judge.
Stubble Judge lives with the high Stubble Judge.
Should be judging himself. That's a lot of stubble.
He also made all these great graphics that go with Tim Kitzrow's incredible voice. So I got to show you my favorite one.
And this question comes all the way from the second stall, the men's room at the Home Depot, just outside of Lansing. You know, I've never been able to locate a restroom at the Home Depot. Not a once. I just go in the drywall aisle. No one's around.
See, that's just audio until, you know, Stubble Judge makes it into something really fun. It was a really good point. Thank you for talking about that. Although I did have to say, I was thinking about, you know, the new world and non-binary kids. They're just in the hallway. Like, they don't even get a class now. They're screwed. They're just, all right. I guess they get to pick one. But it's a whole new world out there for inclusivity, and it's starting a lot younger, and it's interesting to see where it goes. Just saw something on Reddit, by the way, of a person who works at a hospital and assigned male at birth, and said, I told my HR department that I like to dress as a woman. Sometimes I cross dress. And so they let this person have two IDs, one in female and one in male form. I said, no, that's something else. Yeah. That's getting inclusive.
Yeah.
Two IDs.
People, we often don't practice the shit like that because we think that it's just going to make us too uncomfortable.
Right.
Like, it really doesn't. If you let people be themselves in the workplace and they're not using their identity to harm anybody else, give them the accommodation that they need to do the work that they're supposed to do. It's not
exactly
hard.
It. Eddie Izzard finally, or I shouldn't say finally, that seems weird, came out as, you know, changing their pronoun choices to she and her. But Eddie has been a cross-dressing comedian for a very, very long time. And when he identified as he, would say, so I'm in a dress today. Who cares? So I got lipstick on. I got heels. It's all good. Same jokes, you know. And he just sort of put it, she just sort of put it in their face to say, you know, this is just how it is. You know, it's all going to go the same way. Don't worry. And I think that's worth it. Hey, we're at the part of the show where we got to do a person of the
day. Oh, and here's our person of the day. Kaboom!
So torn. I'm so torn because I do want to, you know.
You're torn like a baseball card.
Like a torn baseball card. I'm in 7,000 pieces. I want to give it to Stubble Judge because, you know, first Twitch commenter, but I'm so happy Carol came back. I want to give it to Carol. So you get yourself an apple, Carol. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Woo-woo. Come on, Carol.
I, you know, secretly it should also be some Stubble Judge. All right, listen to me. We have to do also the backpack question. This is a question of what goes in your backpack. It could be anything. It could be something physical, like some really sharp scissors to tear up some baseball cards. It could be something metaphorical, like an absolute need for people to feel seen and understood. It's whatever you want it to be. So I'm going to start with Dr. Cheryl Ingram. Dr. CI, what do you got?
How many? I don't have any limits.
One. No limits to size, though.
Oh, one thing to go in my book. I'm going to say courage. I'm going to put courage in my bag.
Courage is a good one. I like courage. It's a very needed one.
Yeah.
Tim Carroll, what goes in your backpack?
All right, mine's I only get one, so I'm going to use something that's got multiple facets to it. How about that? Okay. Let's go with a remote control. And
I like it.
The remote control is more of a metaphor than anything. All the little buttons on there, you can kind of relate to things in your life. You can't really go back in time, but you can rewind or reflect, you know, on things that's happened to make yourself better at whatever it is you're doing, whether it's your career, you as a person. You can't fast forward, but you can, you know, plan, you can prepare. You can't pause time, but you need to take a minute, just take a deep breath and you know, catch yourself and pay attention to what's going on around you. And the most important one is the play button. And that's just to enjoy things as they're happening. You only have one life to live. So, you know, enjoy it. And if all else fails, you've always got that channel button that you can flip and change the channel, you know, do something different or shake something up.
Cut up cards for a living.
That's it. Exactly. Go from teaching to cutting cards.
Wow. Double Judge says, I've already been person of the day before.
Mm-hmm. Everybody has eventually because, you know, we only know so many people. But Chip Griffin says, I have a stale stick of Topps gum in his backpack.
I want to see him chew it on air.
Yeah.
Oh, my baby.
Hey, Starbird Jack is on Twitch watching us too. Hey, Jack, good to see you.
My followers.
Yo, buy some followers. We got our first Twitch spam. We got our
first Twitch spam.
Looks like we made it.
I'm so excited. Actually, we got it times two.
Oh my gosh. This is a day going out of history. All right. I did forget to mention one detail when I was doing all the show explanation. So one thing I would say is that my grandmother worked in a paper mill. And she made toilet paper, paper towels, and tissue, depending on the day. Because they thought, like, the best idea if you work in a mill is if they switch around which paper product, you would not get bored. Today, it's toilet paper, kids. You know, and you'd be all excited. And I was just thinking, I wonder what she'd think about with regards to this. You know, if she tore up a whole bunch of toilet paper, could she have made some art with it? And I think more. Thanks, Jack. You're so right. I think if she made a bunch of wadded up toilet paper and then, I don't know, maybe colored it with some food coloring or something, I think, you know, what we'd get out of that experience is just something like this.